Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Business of Cyber. My guest today is Uri May, who is the CEO and co-founder of Hunters. Now, Uri and the company are both based in Tel Aviv, and this is the first episode that I'm releasing since Hamas's attack on Israel that started on October 7th. Now, Uri and I met a couple of weeks beforehand, and obviously a lot changed since that conversation happened. So the discussion that you're about to listen to is sort of one of my typical CEO founder interviews as Hunters is attempting to disrupt the SIEM space. It's a really compelling company. I am fortunate to have had the chance to meet with Uri. And I think really anyone that's building a company, especially right now and trying to disrupt an established space like SIEM, is going to get a ton out of this conversation. Lastly, before we get into the episode, I do just want to take a minute to sort of express my thoughts and my prayers, especially with the people of Israel. This was a completely inhumane and barbaric attack that has zero justification. And I truly am praying that leadership on both sides will find the necessary strength and the necessary wisdom to, of course, safely return the hostages, but also find peace as soon and as quickly as possible. So with that, I'm excited to introduce an incredible entrepreneur, Uri May. Uri, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, as a way to kick us off, why don't you give us a little bit of background and some context as to how you have found your way to be the CEO and co-founder of Hunters?
Yeah, so I mean, honestly, like in startups, it was very random, at least the journey up until today. But initially speaking, like when we started the company, Tomer and I think it's interesting, like in Israel, a lot of times founders are just getting together to start a company without necessarily having like a very clear pain or a very clear problem. It's just they're into like start kicking off the entrepreneurship journey. And that was our case. And actually, like in the beginning, like we weren't high on cyber, and it wasn't like we had amazing kind of like ideas regarding cyber. We had a lot of experience and very unique set of capabilities, like from our past in the army, etc. But a lot of VCs and like investors that we've talked with about like other ideas in other verticals are like, why aren't you doing a cyber company? Sounds like it could be like a place that that you can really contribute. And in the beginning, we were cynical to that because that's kind of like the immediate choice. But at some point, it grew on us, and we double click into it, and we researched the market, and we came up with kind of like the vision behind Hunters, and we're kind of like sticking to that even until now, which is really unique. I mean, just looking back and imagining everything that we went through. So yeah, I mean, that's that.
I'm curious, what were maybe some of the ideas that you guys had that weren't cybersecurity related?
Yeah, so I mean, my craziest thing, and this was before I joined Tomer, was like, I'm really into space since I was a kid. Like, I really like it. Don't necessarily have any unique advantage or deep understanding of it, but it always fascinated me. And I got really excited by the whole concept of like small satellites sensing Earth from above. And like, I don't know, it's like 2017, 2018, SpaceX like just started, and like it felt that there's gonna be a lot of like, felt is not the right word, everyone talked about it, like commercialization of space. Launches are going to be much cheaper. Everything that happened around mobile phone and the hardware that is related to that really commoditized a lot of the stuff that you need to make very smart devices. And it just created a proliferation of like companies that are sending satellites to space, which is something that up until now was saved only for like defense contractors or like the Airbus and the Boeing and like those types of companies. And I saw it as an opportunity to potentially do like an infrastructure kind of like play around. Let's build the operating system for satellites. Because if everyone wants to send stuff to space, maybe they all need like, you know, infrastructure. And with satellites, it's not just what's running on the hardware itself. It's also the communication, the protocols, ground stations. Like I had this whole very grandiosic vision around it. But yeah, that was that. But it was interesting times. And I do think that still like space is obviously a massive opportunity. But
maybe your next company.
maybe.
Yeah, cool. So why Hunters? Like why did you land on Hunters as sort of the company that you founded?
So, I mean, one of the things that we were really interested in when we kind of like did ideation and worked with investors, and we had like the privilege of having a lot of access to security practitioners and CISOs from all over the world. And I think it's like a good chance to kind of like, you know, thank everyone that kind of like supported us in the beginning. There's something very weird on the cyber ecosystem. People are genuinely want to help each other. And there is this real feeling of like doing good for the greater good. And from the outside, it's very easy to be cynical about it because there are like thousands of companies and like hundreds of thousands of people that are kind of like doing it. But like at the end of the day, it's like, it's a very complex problem. And people are really out there for each other in a very human and interesting kind of like way. And we got that support. Like people genuinely wanted to help us find the right idea. Which is not trivial because, I mean, you're a CISO of a Fortune 500 company. Why would you care? And they care. I mean, they understand that they need innovation and they also want to support entrepreneurs in the beginning of their way. So that was super cool. And one of the biggest things that we asked everyone was like, where are some of the biggest challenges? Not just like security challenges, but like, or technological challenges, but challenges like operational problems. And there was a lot of like, a lot of people pointed at the security operations center, which, I mean, it makes a lot of sense because at the end of the day, like you have a lot of technology and a lot of security products and sensors and tech deployed inside the perimeter, outside the perimeter, whatever. But at the end of the day, all of that data is flowing into this operational center that makes decisions about what's a threat, what's not a threat, what's a policy deviation, what's an approved kind of like action. And that's where the rubber meets the road, right? Like that's where you start seeing that it's not like technology has limitation, but technology that is not operationalized the right way has no ability to drive like the impact or the maximize its potential. We really liked it because it's people, process, and technology, right? Like it's an operational problem. It's an open-ended problem. And it can be huge. I mean, you can build a big company around it, which in security, in a lot of cases, like you start small and then you hope that maybe at some point you'll become a platform. For us, we started with the use case, but it was very clear that at some point it will need to be something that is bigger. And by the way, it also comes with challenges. We can talk about it when we'll talk about some go-to-market challenges that we had. But it was a combination of areas where we think that we can have like contribution in terms of like our domain expertise and understanding. And it also had a was a space, security operation in general, where there's a combination of existing market, but still a lot of room for innovation, and huge total addressable market with a lot of pain.
Yeah. Just to dig into that a little bit more, I'm curious sort of what it was like entering an established market as sort of a new provider, right? Where what you're positioning is sort of a better or newer way to do something that a lot of our large enterprises are already doing versus maybe creating an entirely new segment where nobody's doing that. So what was that experience like for you?
So, I mean, first of all, it took me at least time to understand how meaningful that thing is. Like, the choice of like operating in a red ocean versus operating in a blue ocean, like how meaningful that decision is. I'm not sure. Again, in startups, a lot of chaos, a lot of random, a lot of entropy. Not everything is being like, you know, conscious decisions. And I think that around the thing that you just mentioned, there was a lot of intuition that came to play. But at some point, we understood that, I mean, augmentation is not the right kind of like way, and it will put us in a very, very vulnerable position. And being an add-on might be relevant in certain cases, but we can't build a strategy around it. Like, we have to go after taking out the incumbent and like replacing. And one of the biggest challenges around what we're trying to replace is that it's very broad and mature technologies that have a lot of very deep capabilities. We believe that they have a lot of gaps and that they have a lot of like problems and challenges, and they're not really delivering on their premise, but still, you know, it's like it's out there for like 15, 20 years. And it was really interesting to start navigating that function between the customers that we want to tackle with the capabilities that we have, and which capabilities we need to develop to gain which kind of customers. And it's still, we're still on that path, right? Like, I think that one of the biggest challenges when you're in a red ocean that is ripe for disruption, but in the same time you have a huge TAM, is like staying focused and making hard decisions about who you're going after and who you're not going after. And I feel that that's one of our biggest challenges. I mean, it's just, it's very hard to say no to pipeline. And I think that everyone that is out there would kind of like agree, but that's what you need to do at the end of the day. And it took us like a very long time to start doing it. And I can, you know, complete transparency, we should do it more. It's always like a delicate balance between staying in your lane, but also challenging yourself a little bit to see how it looks like in other lanes. Again, especially when you're building like an horizontal technology that is not necessarily verticalized in an easy way, and where you can actually approach multiple segments of the market and also to multiple go-to markets. Like, we have a relatively elaborated chain of partners and alliances and resellers for a relatively young company. We don't always necessarily have the go-to-market maturity or processes to support all of that, but that's startups, right? Like, we built a lot of the stuff as we go. But there's a delicate balance into how you do that without always stretching yourself. Like, also kind of like, you know, leveraging your existing successes and doing more of what's working instead of constantly going after areas that are riskier. And I think that that's exactly like the stage that we're in. We already have a good enough amount of data about where we're working really well and where we're not. And we're trying to double click on what's working. And because the TAM is so big, it's something that that is still very lucrative, even if you narrow it down in terms of your ideal customer profile.
And how have you guys sort of narrowed it down? Like, what would be sort of like the ICP that you've defined or you try to focus on at this point?
So that's like the $100 million ARR question. I don't want to talk too much about the ICP itself because it's evolving. I think that what's interesting is like the features that we use, right? Like the qualifiers. So there's like, you know, the usual suspects like vertical and segment and company size and revenue. We're also looking a lot about the persona. Like, we're zooming into the personas. How many people in the SOC? Do they have a CISO? Do they have a threat hunting team? Do they have a big team of detection engineers, security engineers? Like, how does the security practice looks like from a maturity perspective and practitioners? The more different specialized functions that you have and the bigger the teams, obviously it means that the replacement is going to be more challenging because like you need to satisfy the needs of like different practitioners that are like experts in what they do. And it means that they got used to something and now you're taking that away. You need to deliver all of that and then also make them understand that you are better. And with some of those functions, it's very easy for us to come in and demonstrate why we are so much better in an exponential way. And with some of them, it's not. So I'm understanding that and doing the proper discovery and you know, gaining the right account control is something that is super important. So again, the team, the maturity of the team, the incumbent, something that is really important. You know, there's a lot of competitors. For us, for some of them are easier to replace. Again, in some context, like right. It's always kind of like a Cartesian multiplication between the context of the account and what is running today, and making a decision how we want to run it. Do we want to run it as an augmentation, as a replacement? There's a couple of like nuances in the way we work with customers. They can bring in their own data platform, whether it's Snowflake or Databricks, or use our hosted solution. So I mean, the playbook itself is relatively complex, but that's also what makes it interesting. That's also what makes kind of like, you know, our conversations with customers very deep about like where do they want to take their practice, and we're actually offering them something that is very different. Sometimes they're not on the right point on the curve, right? Like it's hard for us to go up with, I don't know, a huge mature enterprise that is kind of like from a vertical that is more aligned with skeptics or late majority or late adopters. But again, that's like, those are like normal challenges. I think that when you combine that with replacing and disrupting like an existing market, a lot of companies are probably sharing the same. The upside is that we're tapping into existing budget. So even when we're augmenting, usually we're able to carve out budget for ourselves by offloading, you know, consumption from the existing solution. And it solves a lot of pain, especially like in the last year and a half, where budgets have shrinked and, you know, in general, people are a bit more hesitative about even thinking about new budget lines or new products or new technologies. I mean, going up to your CFO and asking for another line is something that everyone are going through challenges with. So, I mean, that's our upside. And it's huge. It allows us to grow and even to leverage on that, because a lot of our value proposition has to do with efficiencies. It's not necessarily cheaper, but it's like shorter time to value, lower total cost of ownership, a lot of out-of-the-box capabilities, automation, efficiencies. And it's something that it's a narrative that helps us show ROI relatively quickly in the security market, where ROI is not always that easy to demonstrate.
Yeah. I've got a question about sort of the enablement process that you have built for your go-to-market team. I'm curious to understand it because, you know, like what you described with a complicated market and sort of a nuanced approach where depending on the client's industry and revenue and sort of the typical components of an ICP, but also the technology they're using and sort of the way in which they could be using hunters, it's complicated for, you know, a rep to find, yes, this could be a good opportunity for us and it's worth our time. So maybe could you walk me through and just sort of describe what you've learned from an enablement standpoint to get your team comfortable with that?
So I don't think that we figured that out yet. Like a lot of it is just tribal knowledge that, you know, we're having a lot of discussions about it. We're talking a lot about it. I think the next level for us, and that's something that I'm working now with like very talented people on our ops department to try and, you know, productize a lot of that knowledge into an asset or a tool that can be helpful. And the best kind of like approach that we have now is to create a qualification metric. So you plug in all of the data, like whatever, into Salesforce, and like as you go to Bunt and Medpeak and all of the processes that we're using in our playbook, the more accurate the score that you're getting on the fit of the account gets. And that gives you as a rep kind of like a good proxy to the conversion, right? Yeah, like okay. It yeah. doesn't necessarily model the conversion because, I mean, at the end of the day, we can, you know, not succeed in the POC or coming too expensive or a lot of stuff that aren't necessarily relevant for qualification. But if the qualification score is really low, it means that the conversion will be in a different kind of space in terms of like a step function that kind of like describes it. And that's what we figure out as kind of like the best way to help the sellers to understand what they're working on. And, you know, maybe we'll be able to also create some kind of a self-explanatory type of score. But even if not, it gives you a better understanding of where your pipeline is at. And how things are looking. So, I mean, that's something that we're exploring now. I can't say that we figure that out, but it's definitely like one of our challenges.
Yeah. When you guys were earlier understanding, you know, obviously, you know, it's, you know, you've raised what, over 100 million, a couple hundred employees at this point. But I'm curious maybe to go back to like the earlier phases of the business when you were still experimenting and figuring this out. Could you walk us through just kind of like walk me through just sort of the lessons that were learned or the experiences you had trying to define, all right, what are the components of our ICP?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the first challenge for me was like, and it sounds weird and it sounds like a cliche, but I really hated sales calls in the beginning. Like I felt that I'm bad at it. I always hated the presentations that I was generating, and I kind of like hated talking with customers. Like I didn't hate the customers. I enjoyed the conversation because I like talking with people, but I hated being in a position that I need to convince them to listen to me and to buy something that like I'm selling. Like it took me a long time to grow on it and to actually like it. And like I had this script counting like the number of interactions that I have like with customers, whatever. Like I think after a year and a half, I had like 500 customer calls or something like that. Like just, I was like on the phone 14, 16 hours a day and like changing the presentations constantly and like overthinking about every single word that I said and like the feedback that they gave. And it was a brutal experience for me personally, but I think it really helped me understand, or at least feel that I understand, or have the confidence to feel that I understand what are the problems. Mm-hmm. So like through selling stuff that we didn't really have, right? Because in the beginning, we're basically selling code and futures. And by listening to the feedback, I had this feedback loop in the back of my head that kept on kind of like feeding. And at some point, like, I felt that there was like a really big eureka moment. I think that what we didn't do good enough back then is that it wasn't collaborative enough. I didn't have enough people on the team with me on those calls. So a lot of like that knowledge and that experience and that like intuition was stuck in my head. And it kind of like put me in a situation where, you know, I'm the oracle or I kind of like lead the way. And it's like, it's okay, but it's a suboptimal position to be in. Like collaboration is always better. You know what I'm saying? And I mean, multiple opinions interpreting the same conversation is always better than, you know, having voices in your head that only right. you can hear and like, run through them. So, I mean, that was one thing, just listening and persuading and getting pushbacks and doing that whole interaction. Because at the end of the day, like we have a very unique set of tools around cybersecurity, and like me and the founding team, and also, you know, in general, like people that come from the security industry in Israel, massive talent, very successful people. We don't necessarily understand what it means to run security operations center for a Fortune 500 company. Like,
yeah,
it's not what we do. We do a lot of other things that are very unique, but I mean, for me, like I learned everything from scratch. I didn't know those things. I didn't know how people work. I didn't know how people think. I didn't know how US enterprises are kind of like thinking about cyber in general. So that phase was like critical. And I think that once we had that, it was more of like understanding, forming a thesis about what we think that will happen, right? Because I mean, when you're going after replacing something, you need to be pretty sure that there's going to be a replacement cycle or that customers are actually into replacing, that they will be out there looking. Because if you end up trying replacing something that no one wants to replace because it's working, it's like a very bad situation to be in, because you end up boiling the ocean and re-educating them on why they need to replace something. And then it's even harder than selling into a white space or into a blue ocean. So, I mean, and again, everything is a little bit like on the fly in these early days, but we started forming a thesis about like the gap that customers have with their existing solution, with the SIEM and the SOAR, and what's not working and why it's not working, what are the limitations and what are the fundamental architectural problems and what are more, you know, just innovation gaps. And once that was established, we were really able to make very smart decisions about the way we're architecting our solution. I think one of the earliest ones was, you know, just deciding that we're not going to make money out of data. That was very controversial back then, because a lot of our competitors at the end of the day were priced by the amount of data they're processing. And that was the leading kind of like, you know, value that they were generating. They were low aggregators. And we were like, okay, it's very clear that the world is going to data platforms. Like today we have Snowflake and Databricks and others. And as a security vendor, it's going to be impossible to compete with them in scale, performance, capabilities, security, etc. So we need to embrace them. And yeah, we architected our entire solution around Snowflake. We were the first ones doing it in the security space. And we paved the way to a whole category of like vendors that are doing it now. And this year, a couple of months ago, we announced, we GA'd our Databricks integration that gives Databricks customer the same kind of like capability. So I mean, decisions like that are coming from like deep understanding of the problems and then some kind of like a foresight into the future were the things that really helped us shape the go-to-market, and also to some extent led to the ICP, because we had those capabilities. It's like, okay, who would want that? And right, we also have Snowflake as a partner now. Who can Snowflake bring us to? And how all of those things are kind of like converging together.
Yeah, got it. Okay. I'd love to maybe step back a bit to, you know, what you described about sort of your initial reaction was maybe not being a big fan of like the selling process. How did you maybe learn to like it? Or maybe how has that evolved over the last few years of running Hunters?
I think, I mean, it's hard for me to talk about myself in that regard, but I think that I'm pretty good at like consistently do stuff, even if they're very painful. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, I have the discipline for that. And I think it was just that. Like, I had calls that I came out of them like so excited and like, wow, I figured it out. And I had calls that I came out to the team and was like, oh crap, I don't know what the fuck are we doing here. And it's like,
right.
And I mean, it was so challenging. The variance, like, and the emotional roller coaster was so challenging, but I kept on going. And it's like, it's not linear. It's actually a step function. Like, you go through that function at some point, like you gain confidence, you feel comfortable. And that also like leads to better conversation, right? Because people like to talk with people that are comfortable and confident, and at some point I stopped selling. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was just jumping on calls and talking with CISOs and practitioners the same way we're talking. And like, listen, I don't want to sell you on anything. I want to listen to your problems. I want to share our thoughts about the market. And who knows, maybe there's a fix. You know what I'm saying? And if there is, amazing. If not, both of us learn something. And that really opened up a lot of like emotional bottlenecks, because it wasn't like winning or failing anymore. It was more of like, you know, having conversations, and then maybe having those conversations lead to other conversations. And I think that even now, I mean, that when I'm working with our sales teams and when I'm joining customer calls, I mean, I think that's my secret thing. And I think that's the secret thing that a lot of like founders, CEOs can pull in, that for sellers is really hard, because a seller can't really pull off, like, listen, I just want to have a conversation. It's like, obviously you don't just want to have a conversation. Like, yeah. You want to sell right. me on something, and that's fine. I mean, that's everyone are kind of like doing what they're doing. But I think that's magic, because I mean, I have conversations with customers that are fascinating, and that sometimes I'm trying to kind of like in the back of my head imagine how other people in the company can have, and it's hard to get to that type of like relationship.
And I think this is an interesting area where, you know, obviously it's something you maybe had to learn or were experiencing for sort of the first time as you were founding Hunters. But I'm curious to hear a little bit more broadly, just kind of your perspective on how your background maybe prepared you for entrepreneurship.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think I was prepared. Let's talk about that. I don't know how other people experience it, but for me, like it still requires like a lot of changes, like in like evolving and working on stuff and deep things, like personality related things, like not just, you know, being more educated about the market or understanding the competition better or learning about complaints, like stuff that are harder to kind of like even reckon and be aware of. So I'll start with that, just in the name of like humbleness and humility. Listen, I think that from childhood I was raised in a very kind of like supportive and enabling environment. And my education wasn't like, you're so special, you'll be successful. It was more of like, you need to show up every day and work hard, and then if you do, maybe something special will happen. You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe not. I mean, who knows? Like, life is hard, but I mean, you have to show up. Like, you need to work hard, and it's like, be smart. That was a big thing in my uprising. And I think that's the case with entrepreneurship. Like, it's not one skill set that you need. It's like persistency and consistency and believing and like being determined and being disciplined and being self-aware. I think that's probably the most important fit that I think, you know, entrepreneurs needs to have. And it's very hard because you're the CEO, you're completely disconnected. No one tells you the truth. You're kind of like isolated. Sometimes you're lucky to have like executives and people around you that are able to drive very authentic conversation with you, but sometimes you don't. And I mean, I think that is something that I feel that I had, that I'm strong at, and really helped me, the ability to retrospect. And for sure, I mean, there are people that are listening to it now and saying, oh, he's not that self-aware. I mean, for sure, I'm failing at it from time to time. But I'm trying to be aware to how aware I am. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like how connected and how kind of like attached I am. I'm saying a lot. It's like, it's a 90s gangster rap type of like quote, you know, don't get high on your own supply. Like, I really believe in it.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's something like, it's in startups, like you need to keep on reminding it to yourself. False sense of security is like your biggest enemy. I mean, not just for CEOs, for every executive, for every employee in startup, for startups themselves, like that's what kills companies eventually. And I think that the other thing is like, obviously, like, and again, it's very different, and it's like, it's also like the founding team is important, and in general, like the space that you're in. But for me specifically, like coming from research, coming from security, coming from R&D helped. It gave me an anchor. You know what I'm saying? Like I could come into conversations, those horrible conversations that I mentioned earlier. Like I could come in and like I'm someone. I had this internal confidence in my capabilities and the stuff that I did in my past that allowed me to be there and again go through all of that roller coaster, but to show up and be very confident that the other side is at least interested in what I have to say. Like what yeah. I have to say count. I'm an expert. Like I know what I'm talking about. And I don't think that it's always needed. Like I think it depends on who you are and you know, there's CEOs and founders that are like huge on business acumen and kind of like huge on like understanding the world from a business perspective. I think that's precious. Specifically for us in our journey, I feel like the fact that I came with really strong R&D background helped me kind of like, you know, fit into those early conversations and build also the other part of my brain, which I didn't necessarily have experience with, you know, understanding business and finance. But yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, one of the bigger challenges that you're experiencing being sort of the focus and like definition of ICP. So that may be the answer to this next question, but I'm curious just to understand, like within the topic of self-awareness, like what's the biggest challenge that maybe you experience just when you think about running Hunters today?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's the whole of the go-to-market things that we've talked about, but if I'm taking it to the personal level, I think that one of the things that are still like a big challenge for me is being able to articulate what I want in a very clear way. Like, it took me like, I think that for the first time in Hunters, I understood how hard it is sometimes to just say what you want. I mean, when you talk with employees, when you talk with executives, when you talk with investors, just clearly state what you want to happen and like drive collaboration up. Don't just throw it there. Like make sure that the other side actually understood it. And it sounds very, very basic, but I think it's something that sometimes we're discounting. Like I think that we're in our lives, we're operating most of us in a way where we assume the other side understands the signals we're sending. Mm-hmm. Like when you're a CEO, that doesn't work. Like in a lot of cases, you need to be very explicit. And sometimes being explicit can be intrusive and not pleasing and maybe hard to cope with. And it doesn't mean that it needs to be aggressive or anything like that. It's just, it is what it is. And I think that that is still something for me that is like fascinating for me because I think I'm good with words, you know what I'm saying? And I think I know what I want. But sometimes like packaging it in the right way and delivering that message in a clear way is something that that is challenging.
Yeah. And just to elaborate on that, would an example be like just being too indirect with something, basically?
I think being too indirect, I also think that, I mean, sometimes we want to drive very inclusive processes. You know what I'm saying? Like, we want to have the buy-in, like we're in tech, right? Like buying is super important. Like you want people to feel engaged. You want them to own the decision. But at the end of the day, in some cases, it's counterproductive. Like what they actually want is you to tell them what you think that is the right thing and allow them to push back or to create a conflict around it. But the vacuum that is sometimes being created in you know, some of the discussions and some of the conversations, it's not constructive. It's actually on the contrary. Like we all need guidance. We all need direction. And when you're a leader, especially when you're an executive, especially when you're a CEO, it's kind of like, it's one of the basic things that you have to do. It's like one of those things that, you know, you can't mess up on. And you need to be consistent and you need to be clear. So it's stressful. Like, you need to say what you want in a clear way. You need to mean it and it needs to be the right thing. And if it's not the right thing, it's fine. Everyone makes mistakes, but then you need to be very self-aware, vulnerable, and confident to come in and say, I was wrong. This is the right thing. And I mean, obviously, there's so many times that you can do it around a single decision before it becomes annoying.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Well, one just sort of like bigger topic that I want to get into before we move on to the quick fire round. And it's probably another topic that we could do like a whole separate interview on or conversation on, but especially just given like Hunter's position at kind of the bleeding edge of a mature or a established market, I guess, SIEM market, and like partnerships that you guys have with Databricks and Snowflake, I'm really curious to understand your point of view on AI. Obviously, like the biggest buzzword in the universe right now, but sort of deeper than that, I'd love just to see maybe your point of view or perspective on how your customers, right, larger enterprises, will be utilizing AI in their security programs.
So, I mean, I think that at the end of the day, LLMs have huge untapped potential. Like, I'm confident that we're just scratching the surface in terms of like, you know, use cases and how to activate it. But at the end of the day, it's like, it's a very specific technology. And like, it's good. It's like, it's doing a really good job at understanding text and generating text.
Yeah.
And cyber at the end of the day is a classification problem. Is this a threat or not? Is this a policy violation or not? Yes, there are some generative aspects to it, like generate the best policy possible after going through all of the possible policies and understanding my context, etc. Understand this log and automatically parse it. Like, there are cool use cases, but if you look on like one of the biggest challenges that security operations centers have today, which is the processes of threat detection, incident response, it's not a generation problem. It's not a text problem. It's a classification problem. Now, LLMs might be also relevant for classification. There's a lot of research now going on like treating log lines, for example, as text. And if we can understand the text, maybe we can find anomalies. But it's like, it's not there yet. So, I mean, I think that until we see that going on, it's hard to bet on like Gen AI as a detection engine or as a decision support system that is very powerful. I think there's a lot of opportunities around automation, making the analyst's life easier, taking a lot of information, making it more concrete and more actionable. Explain things. Why is this threat a threat? What happened? Looking at this entity and the activity and the timeline that it had. What am I looking at? So, I mean, all of those things are amazing opportunities, and we're pursuing them in Hunters. I think that my bottom line is, like, it's yet to be told, and I'm not sure that I have, like, the good answer about just how pivotal it will be. There is a case where it won't be as impactful in security as I'm sure it will be in, like, another aspects of the enterprise. Like, it's going to change a lot of things. I'm not sure that security will be the area where it will have the biggest impact. I mean, I don't have that conviction. I know that other people that are really bought into it, I'm super bought into it. Like, I'm ChatGPT basically open 24/7. I'm not sure that it will be like the, you know, silver bullet or game changing technology now. Not yet.
Yeah. And what do you think it'll take to get there?
I think that what we haven't experimented a lot with, and by no, like, I'm not an AI expert, but it feels like LLM are one technology, but we also have a lot of other technologies, deep learning and like classical ML and NLP. And there's a lot of stuff that have been developed in the last 50 years. And I think that once we'll start combining those things and tame a little bit the beast that is called LLMs and like kind of like GPT technology and understand how we're fusing it and integrating it with other stuff that we know how to do, I think that can unlock a lot of things. I mean, people are talking about like agentive technologies and like, you know, general artificial intelligence, like a lot of those buzzwords will be based on multiple disciplines. And even now, if you look on like GPT-4, I mean, one of the really cool things, it has multiple cores, right? Like there's a core that was trained on all of the source code in the world. And there's a core that was trained, I mean, and then at the end, there's like an assembly of like cores that finds the specialized core for every kind of like problem that it needs to solve. And I really believe in that. Like I'm an engineer, it's not like an engineering approach to the problem, but I think that's the right thing and the right way to think about it. But I mean, who knows? I mean, it's such a intangible kind of like technology still. I think there's also so much more art than science. And I had a chance to listen to a couple of like people from foundational model companies that are actually building like LLMs model from scratch. And even they speak about like the voodoo behind tuning the model. Like no one really understands what's going on and it's not empiric enough to, and I think that we'll get there, like we'll understand. And that would be like, that will be a moment in time where we might see another singular effect like we saw in the beginning of this year. We had it and everyone will kind of like amazed.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Well, I know we don't have a ton of time left, so let's go ahead and jump into the rapid fire round. Basic premise is I ask a few quick questions and you share whatever comes top of mind. Sound good?
Cool. Yeah.
All right. What's your favorite book?
Wow. Mr. Vertigo by Paul Auster.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about it.
So basically, I read it in Hebrew, so I'm translating to English, and it was originally written in English, so I'm probably going to do a lousy job. But it's about this kid that is meeting this fictional character that is taking him to a very emotional, complicated journey of discovering himself through the premise of learning how to fly. So you basically need to suffer a lot and like get to know yourself in the deepest places, and then you get the chance to fly. And it's a really cool book.
Love it. Yeah, very nice. Cool. If you could change one thing about our industry, what would it be?
The trust issues between customers and vendors.
Hmm.
The fact that in a lot of cases, you're going into a conversation with a customer and the first thing that comes to their mind, it's not all the time, obviously, but some of the time is like, oh, they're just, everything that they're saying is bullshit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? In security, the whole concept of like proof of concept or proof of value, like in the sales process, is based on the fact that like the customer doesn't believe that you can do what you say that you can do in the presentation. I think it's counterproductive at the end, like for both sides. Like, I don't think that you should have like blind trust, but I think that there's a better point on the graph than where we are today.
Yeah. Who's someone in the industry that you really admire?
I had a chance to listen to George Kurtz a couple of times and like, I felt that he's a really inspiring person. And I mean, obviously like CrowdStrike is definitely a company to look up to and dissect every single move they did along the way and try and learn from it. So.
Yeah. Cool. And last question, if you could go back in time and get a drink with your 20-year-old self, what advice would you give him?
You're not smart. You're stupid. Don't forget that. I think that, like, you know, in our 20s, and I think everyone was kind of like going through it, I felt it like very aggressively. You think that you're the inventor of hot water, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was confident that a lot of the stuff that I'm figuring out are like, you know, unique. And that I figured it out, and from now on, everything is going to be amazing. Because I've learned that thing. And you know, at the end of the day, it's like everyone are going through a journey and you understand stuff, you don't understand stuff, like you keep on evolving. I think that humility and humbleness are things that, I mean, I didn't have in my 20s. I think I have more of them now. You always need more of them regardless. But I think it could reduce some of the pain that I suffered in a couple of occasions through my 20s.
Yeah. It's funny. That's I ask that question to everybody that I interview here. It's always the last one. And one of the reasons I ask it is advice I got from a mentor when I was like 16, when I was a kid, was like, when you're 16, you think you know everything. And then you're going to turn 18. And then your 18-year-old self thinks your 16-year-old self was an idiot. But now your 18-year-old self has the world figured out. And then you turn 21 and the same cycle continues. So that was his advice, was always like, recognize that you've got a lot to learn. And you never really have the world figured out, especially when like you're young, like, you know, 16, 18, 20 years old. So that's cool. That's good advice.
Yeah. I think in your 20s, it's also like, everything is binaric. Yeah. You either figure it out, or you don't. Like, and I mean, I think that as we grow, we understand that everything is linear, everything is on a spectrum. It's like there's a lot of opinions. Everything is complicated. The world isn't black or white. At some point, you start having kids, and that completely changes like everything again. So I mean, yeah,
cool. Well, Uri, I've really enjoyed this, man. Thank you so much for taking the time.
The pleasure was mine, Joe. Thank you for having me.